you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 3750 Wilkins against Methodist Healthcare System, and Justice Brister is recused in this case.
May it please the court, Mr. Lee will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner deserves 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is the case that's about the necessity of service on a misidentified defendant. The one thing that is real clear about this litigation is that neither one of the lower courts that looked at the situation, neither the trial court nor the court of appeals, felt like the system worked as it probably ought to in this set of circumstances.
I'm unclear about how it ought to work. What rule do you think should be used in a situation like this so that we would feel better about it?
I think that there are two possibilities that face the court. There is a broader and a narrower approach. The broader approach would be to expand the Hillard line of reasoning to a situation where service was not effective. And that is to say that if you've got a situation where the proper party, and when I say proper party, I mean the one the plaintiff means to sue, the proper party has been misidentified, that the proper party is related to a sued party, and they have substantially similar sorts of names, but the proper party has notice. And here I think what the cases are telling the court is it has to be actual notice. It's not a constructive kind of notice, but has notice of the litigation, and that the fact that the proper party wasn't sued or in this particular set of circumstances served does not operate to disadvantage the party, then under those set of circumstances, not naming that party, or in our circumstance, not serving that party, should not be viewed as having no consequence. The idea that the misidentification cases, which is the Hillard line of cases, revolves around, is if someone has notice of the claim, and if they are not prejudiced by the fact that they may not have been named, or, again, in our circumstances, served with process, then they should not be heard to assert a limitations defense. That's the wider.
How related do they have to be? What if there were two subs? They were not wholly owned. They were in a corporate chain, but they were cousins. They weren't parent and subsidiary like this case.
I think that's going to be a fact-driven kind of answer. And I think it's easy in this case, and it's easy to think of cases where it's not difficult. Sister companies may not be related enough. The relationship has to be accompanied by a similarity of names. The idea, I take it, is that the plaintiff is easily misled when the plaintiff is dealing with the Methodist healthcare system and the Methodist hospital, each of which do business under three or four different assumed names that are variations of
What if the plaintiff is not misled? What if the records show that the plaintiff knew very well that there were differences in these entities, even though they have similar names? Would the rules still apply?
That's an exceptionally interesting question, one that I hadn't thought of until this very moment. But it would seem to me like if the plaintiff is not misled, that is, if the plaintiff intentionally sues the wrong party, hard to imagine why that would occur, but if that occurs, then certainly the plaintiff ought not to be given the advantage of what is admittedly an equitable exception to the normal functioning of the statute of limitations.
And what if it's not intentional, but it's, for lack of a better word, reckless? They know through their prior dealings that they're separate entities and they have separate functions. Maybe they've had litigation involving both entities before. They know the difference, and that lawyer then file suit against the wrong entity, having that base of knowledge. Would that make sense?
At one point or another, you veer over into lawyer malpractice at least potentially, depending on who's making the decision. Again, because it is an equitable doctrine that we're talking about, I don't think that you give the benefit of the equitable doctrine to somebody who has clearly demonstrated that they don't deserve the benefit of it.
And then how do you demonstrate that you deserve the benefit of equity? When you read the other side's briefs, they say that, you know, this is well known to you, the 4590I letter clearly delineated hospital is different from the system and some of the discovery did, and yet the hospital wasn't sued until limitation orders.
I think you have to look back to the record. I think when you look back to the record, it is clear, it's painfully clear, that what the plaintiff's trial attorneys thought they were doing in this set of circumstances was suing the party that provided medical care to Mrs. Wilkins. And you can see that in terms of what they are alleging in their pleadings, what they are saying in their response to the motion for summary judgment, what they are saying in the hearings before the trial court, and the overall tenor of everything that happened in the trial court is that these folks thought they were getting the hospital. And it's not just the situation where you've got stumble-bum representation of the plaintiff. It's not just they didn't know what they were doing. There is a lot of, if not affirmatively being misled, certainly active omissions on the part of the system that would lead somebody to believe that they had the right party. Remember what happens in this case. Plaintiff has, what is on the face of it, a fairly garden variety medical malpractice case. Plaintiff sues the Methodist Healthcare System doing business as the Methodist Hospital System. Somebody answers. They answer interposing about 25 defenses. The Court of Appeals has some sort of harsh things to say about the selection of those defenses, but significantly, not one of them is a defense that even vaguely alludes, hey, the plaintiff has the wrong party. We didn't do anything. We didn't have any involvement. More importantly, at least from my viewpoint, more importantly, of those 25 defenses, there are a number of them that the system cannot assert. Only the hospital can assert them. It is those defenses, for instance, if you look at the first answer, not the amended answer, but the first answer at paragraphs 12, 16, and 18, you will see that the system is asserting the right to a set-off for all medical services it provided to the plaintiff for which it has not been compensated. Now, the system has no business asserting that defense. That's not a defense it can possibly have unless it's the hospital.
The system is a management entity.
The system is from what we know in our record, the system is a management and risk-adjusting administrative parent corporation that is over Methodist Hospital and a number of other hospitals. What we know for sure that it provides in our case is all of the risk management, risk adjustment kinds of services, because they are the people, that is the people employed by the system, are the people that plaintiffs get in contact with. They are the ones who take the claims as they are coming in and serve as risk adjusters. They also clearly have other administrative functions, which, if it is explored in the record, is escaping my recollection right now. But they're basically the business branch of these various hospitals. They do not, however, provide medical care, so they have claimed in this.
Let's suppose this case had proceeded to judgment. You filed your amended petition, and the system has now filed a verified pleading saying, I'm the wrong person, you've sued me in the wrong capacity. You've amended your petition to name the hospital. The hospital never appears. You get a judgment against the system. Now, how can you, are you, your argument, you can abstract that judgment and then levy on the hospital's assets?
If the way that you proceed to judgment is that you get a judgment against the system, that is to say, if its defense does not prevail, then the judgment is executable against the
system. But you don't have a judgment against the hospital, is my point.
That's correct. And the reason...
Go ahead.
And the reason that sort of feels anomalous is that what the system should be doing is asserting the defense of we are not the correct party.
Which they finally did.
Which they finally did, and the trial court granted.
Okay, so let's...
If you assume the trial court doesn't grant that defense, then they're like any other defendant that had a bona fide defense, lost it at the trial court.
Let's go back then. They filed their 26th amended or whatever it was, defense, and finally verified it 8 months later. So then they filed a motion for summary judgment. So we're the wrong party. We're out of here. And the trial court grants that motion for summary judgment. The hospital has never appeared. You've never served the hospital. Now what are you left with in the trial court?
The hospital has never been served. That is correct.
And they've never appeared.
It's our position that they have, in fact, appeared. They have appeared. In order to appear in Texas, you don't have to file anything. All you have to do is to be acknowledging the jurisdiction of the court over controversy or seeking some sort of affirmative relief. The hospital is in that courtroom seeking affirmative relief.
The system was, not the hospital.
No, the hospital is not there by pleading, but there are defenses that are being advanced on behalf of the hospital.
And let's say the system abandons all those. Files an amended answer, ditches all of those defenses, says we're the wrong people, give us summary judgment, and the trial court does. So then what are you left with in the trial court?
If the system has appeared, then and that's our position. If the court rejects the position that the system has appeared...
The system has appeared, no question.
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon, and I misspoke. It is our position that the hospital has appeared.
Through its parent company?
Yes.
Okay. If we say mm-hmm. you got to get the hospital as a separate, it's a separate entity.
And then ultimately, at one point or another, if you assume the trial court lets the system out, the trial court needs to rule, and it's our position the trial court should have ruled, that the hospital is in the lawsuit, despite the fact that they have not received service of citation. The same way in the misidentification cases that the courts rule that the misidentified parties who admittedly have officially appeared in those cases, but the courts have ruled that if they've had notice and they're not prejudiced, it is as if they had been sued and brought into the lawsuit.
That limitations is told, so you can still go out and serve them, and it's not too late. Isn't that the holding of the cases?
Service is not at issue. This is the first case that is.
I'm just saying, but in those cases, the only issue is saying, well, everybody was worried because limitations had run. Now to serve them, they could say limitations had run. The court said, no, limitations has been told. Isn't that what the holding was?
Could you ask the question again, because I'm about to answer the wrong part of it, I think.
I thought in the misidentification cases that the courts held you can now go serve them, essentially. Limitations is told so that service, you can't raise limitations as a bar once you're brought in.
In the Texas cases, that never happened. That never happens because the misidentified defendant appears, asserts its defense. So service never becomes a question in any of those cases. That's what Judge Brister points out in, I believe it's footnote 16 to the opinion. The odd thing is that we have so much misnomer, misidentification, and assumed name jurisprudence in this state, and we do not have a single case that addresses in this context the necessity of having proper official service of citation.
So the addition you'd make to the Court of Appeals opinion, the Court of Appeals said, okay, there may be equitable tolling in this instance, but tolling until what? And the CA posits tolling until issuance of citation on the proper party. What you would say is tolling until the proper party appears.
I think the Court of Appeals felt constrained to say that you cannot have the equitable remedy that we see in the situation where you have not served or the other party has not voluntarily appealed. I don't read the Court of Appeals opinion as giving us instructions that in this set of circumstances, the lack of service would not be a problem. I think what the Court of Appeals is saying is this court has provided no guidance, and there is no other Texas court to look to that has examined the situation of what you do when the party, the proper defendant, knows that the suit's out there, knows that the intent is to make them the defendant, would not be disadvantaged, but is not served.
And that, and in your rule, there's no component of negligence on the part of the plaintiff. In other words, even if he just doesn't, even look, he just sees Methodist and he says, "Well, I don't know, Methodist system's close enough." Here they went to the Secretary of State and they made some. But if they just, and there were, it might have even been some facts that put them on notice that maybe this was not really the hospital. You would say, well, as long as there's no prejudice, you still get the remedy.
If there is actual notice, I think that's what the cases that are dealing with statute of limitations, that's the way the courts have come down in the past. I am honestly not aware of, and perhaps it's because there are not that many service cases, I am not aware of any court analyzing the problem from the standpoint of what should the plaintiff have done after they get past the threshold inquiry, which is, of course, it would have been awfully nice had the plaintiff joined the proper party within the statute of limitations.
Well, let me make sure I understand your argument. Under your argument, if we were to determine that the hospital appeared, the issuance of citation is irrelevant or immaterial.
It becomes like the misnomer case, is correct.
What the trial court dismissed the case without prejudice against the hospital. Why couldn't you have served the hospital on that date and then go over it?
But from a practical standpoint, by that point in time, limitations has long since run against
it. Not under our case law. I mean, if limitations is told because of the misidentification issue and the trial court has dismissed without prejudice, and you serve the hospital the next day, how are you, why doesn't that work?
It doesn't work in the context in which we're claiming, which the plaintiff is saying, we have joined that party. That if the summary judgment becomes a final judgment, then, wait a minute, that's not correct. That's not correct, because you're right. It is without prejudice. It is still going to be a problem, though, with regard to the statute of limitations, unless something has happened which either tolls or prevents the statute of limitations.
But it would seem like the rationale in our cases would say limitations is told. All you have to do is go serve the hospital and get a minute.
That's not obviously the resolution that either the trial court. We may be talking about different.
Why did
cases.
The trial court go to the pains to dismiss the hospital without prejudice, giving you a chance to go serve it?
I suspect that the trial court entered the order dismissing without prejudice because the trial court had decided to her satisfaction that the hospital had simply never appeared and never subjected itself to the jurisdiction of the court at all in that set of circumstances. If the court decides the party has not subjected itself to its jurisdiction, then a dismissal without prejudice is the only order the court can enter.
So you think in this analysis, the first thing we have to focus on is the hospital's appearance. In other words, if the hospital appeared, a lot of this analysis just goes away.
That's absolutely correct.
But
I don't
if we were determined they have not appeared, then we really do have a problem here, don't we?
If you determine that they have not appeared, the question is, do the four storage factors, which we started out the argument with, proper party misidentified,
which would be tolling equitably, and as
do they I'm sorry.
Justice Brister said, tolling until what? And that was the problem that I understood he focused on in the Court of Appeals opinion. Okay, even given equitable tolling. until what? Until they are served. And if they have not generally appeared to make service irrelevant, you're left with the argument that somehow because they have the same agent, they were. Well, no, I guess you wouldn't have that.
No, I don't think that's correct. It's assuming the very thing I believe it was intending over here, and that is that you have to have service in order to be able to bring them into the lawsuit. If you take the general appearance issue and the conduct, the defendant's conduct-related issues, put all the kind of clustered together out of the picture, the question simply becomes, do those four factors that Hillard says are sufficient to prevent a defendant from asserting limitations apply when that defendant has not been served? And, you know, at that point in time, presumably if you still got a vehicle, you could go out and serve them. It doesn't, we get ourselves, I suppose, or I get myself, into a logical conundrum once we start talking about a court doing something to a defendant that hasn't appeared in any fashion and hasn't been served, but what the four factors were telling you is that's the equivalent of service.
I thought the four factors just related to tone.
Yes, correct.
Irrespective of the service.
And the question is, do we apply those in a situation to, do we apply those to this situation where there has not been service?
Quick question. I haven't looked at the record, but was there like a request for a disclosure? That seemed like that would was the set up for to solve this kind of problem.
A big problem of a big practical problem is that those requests for disclosure, there was specific discovery that was propounded to the system that went to the specific issue of your identity as a defendant and another potential defendant's relationship of the employees that have been identified to you, and in all of those circumstances, the disclosure, the response was there was no other potential parties known, and we have been correctly named. In response to the varying discovery requests, the responses were not calculated to put anybody on notice that the real defense is you've got the wrong party in the lawsuit. The thing that, terribly over time, the cases used to say that the non-identified defendant has no duty to come forward and point out the mistake the plaintiff has made to the plaintiff. It's Matthews Trucking. It's the first time I found that thought. That may still be the law, but under the discovery laws that exist in Texas today, clearly the defendant who's in the lawsuit has the duty to disclose, particularly in this situation, and that duty was not fulfilled in this case.
So you said that wasn't done, so it seems like a possible remedy would be discovery sanctions. Failure to, you lost your case possibly because they didn't answer the questions correctly or in good faith.
That certainly, had it been me, would have been a profitable avenue for the trial attorneys to look into, because I think that there is a tolerable case that discovery abuse existed in this particular litigation, but they did not do that.
You can answer when you come back up on rebuttal, but in response to the disclosure on no response of information, what the system would say was on potential parties that at that time of the disclosure, the hospital was no longer a potential party because limitations had expired by then.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court's ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Pritchett will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'll skip past for the moment whether
The court should adopt an equitable exception, go straight to the equitable exception that's proposed by the plaintiff in this case, and just and point out one thing that I agree with the plaintiff on, and that is the plaintiff knew who the proper defendant was at the time the lawsuit was filed or at the time the lawsuit was amended or any point in the lawsuit, that the equity should not come to the aid of the plaintiff. In this case, I think we've established very clearly that the plaintiff knew that there's two distinct entities, the Methodist Healthcare System and the Methodist Hospital.
What should be the remedy against the system when, let's just assume for a moment that you intentionally withheld information in response to straightforward discovery requests about who were the proper parties? What should be the remedy under those circumstances?
Well, under those circumstances, and that really has no impact on the service question in this case.
What should be the remedy?
If there was some prejudice to the plaintiff, then there may be some remedy under the rules, under the discovery violation type rules. However, in this case, the system did, in July 2001, identify the hospital as the proper party and gave notice and practically begged the plaintiff to sue the hospital.
Why didn't the system do that the day it was served with the
petition? Well, when the lawsuit was originally served, I think the system may have been under a misapprehension, but this was really a products liability suit.
Well, could that be a products liability suit? Well, for leaving something in the body of a woman.
Well, it wasn't left in the body, but the products liability suit, the principal defendant in the suit was filed was Ascolab Labs, who designed the tip and the attachment mechanism for the tip on this laparoscopic instrument.
But it never crossed your mind the hospital would have any liability?
Well, at the time I wasn't involved, so it didn't cross my mind.
You think it was reasonable that it never crossed anybody's mind on the system side that the hospital might possibly be a person with some liability?
I think that the hospital was a person with potential liability, and
then
so
why
was,
weren't they identified?
And so was Dr. Wills, and so were the nurses.
So why weren't they identified?
Because in this case, the hospital, or I'm sorry, the system, believed that the plaintiff was aware of all these entities.
So that gets you off the hook when you're answering interrogatories. I don't have to tell you anything I think you already know.
Well, I think in the interrogatories, we answered the questions. I think I explained in the briefing that the interrogatories were answered accurately. When hospital employees were identified, there was a list of names, and at the bottom it said the Methodist Hospital, and it gave the address. And when system employees were identified, the names were identified, and the system was given as their employer at the bottom of the list of names. So I think that was not misleading. And as far as the request for disclosure, which Justice Smith asked about, I agree that, and I made the argument, that at the time we received the request for disclosure, which was in February 2001, I guess it was 2001. It was 6 or 8 months after the suit had been filed by the time we received those requests for disclosure. The lawsuit against the hospital had been barred by limitations since July 6, 2000. So I think it was accurate for us under those circumstances not to identify the hospital.
Then why were you, as you put it, begging him to sue the hospital years later?
Well, at that point, in order for the hospital to gain a bar, well, for one thing, that the plaintiff had amended, well, not one of the fathers, but the plaintiff did amend the petition and add the hospital as a named defendant, and the system, which was interested in obtaining a final judgment in the case, asked for, or begged, as I said, the plaintiff to file suit against the hospital so that the hospital could make a resolution of the limitations issue. And that really couldn't happen until the hospital was joined. As he said, the system couldn't raise limitations on behalf of the hospital. The hospital had to raise that.
How do you respond to the argument that the hospital made an appearance through its parent system by answering the way it did?
Well, I think under the record, we can't tell whether these defenses belong to the hospital or the system. I think the one identified, whether these medical bills could be offset, I don't know if those medical bills were owed to the system or to the hospital. We don't know under the record. And as far as other defenses, another concern that I would have also in this circumstance is that when answering these kind of lawsuits, if they're small lawsuits, and you don't really know exactly the scope of the lawsuit when it's first brought, it behooves a defendant to assert
as many defenses as may be applicable, and then later winnow it down to the ones that are actually going to apply in this case. And I think that's what was going on when the original answer was filed, was that the defendant was
But not capacity. You didn't think of that one right off the bat.
I think that under the circumstances, we were not the primary defendant. We're asking Lab Gladstone.
But you said you thought what was going on here, that you just put everything you could think of in the defenses, but you just didn't happen to think of capacity along with the other 25 that you were going to say.
Well, that may well have been what happened. The end result of that is that it was asserted. And at that time, if the plaintiff could establish the tolling, not the tolling, but the relation back rule under Highland, our identification of the hospital at that time, assuming that we were acting inequitably, assuming that all that happened, as they said, assuming the system was trying to hide the identity of the hospital, which I don't believe is true, the plaintiff was protected by equity at that point already. The plaintiff could then sue and serve the hospital, and as long as the service was diligent, there's limitations, cases.
But you catch yourself coming and going then, because if that was true, if the Highland could have been asserted then it could have been asserted at the time for disclosure as well, so the hospital would be a potential party, which you didn't name in response to a legitimate discovery request.
Possibly, but I'd also think that until Askelap Labs was dismissed as a defendant, and just at the same around the same time that we amended our answers, we really did pursue this case, and we thought the case was being pursued as a products liability case. And if that was an honest mistake, it was an honest mistake. And that would be something that could be determined.
But the hospital was involved in using the instrument as well. So, I mean, I still understand how when you cast it as a products liability claim, that explains why you didn't identify the hospital as a potential liable party.
Well, the plaintiff has the option of choosing which defendant they wish to sue, and that's what it appeared to happen in this case.
But then they ask you, who else could be liable? Aren't you obligated to tell them?
I looked actually to find out if there was any guidance on the scope of the requirement of disclosure under the rule of disclosure, and I couldn't find anything. And I think that the best I can answer that is that our best good faith belief at the time was that we were answering it accurately. And because we thought it was a product liability suit, because if they were trying to sue the hospital, even by the time the system received notice, limitations had already expired. And because we didn't believe an equitable exception would apply, because in this case we knew that the plaintiff's attorneys representing the plaintiff had sued the hospital and knew about the hospital. And we knew that under their 4590I letter, they had identified the hospital. So we thought they were fully aware of the hospital as a defendant and chosen not to sue them. There's a couple of federal cases that are in the briefing. One of them is Adamar involving a casino where the plaintiff brought a suit against this casino. The plaintiff had a heart attack while he was at the casino. And the casino's medical director, who was an independent contractor and who oversaw which equipment the casino kept on hand to deal with these kinds of emergencies, rushed to his aid. The man suffered serious and permanent disabilities because of his heart attack, and he sued the casino. Now, the doctor was aware of the suit, was given actual notice, knew all about it, participated in the discovery. And later on, when the plaintiff tried to amend his petition to join the hospital, the court said that the plaintiff's entitled to make a choice between his defendants, and the defendant isn't obligated to interpret the plaintiff's lawsuit, find out what they really meant to do, and volunteer additional defendants, or volunteer yourself as a defendant if you were not sued, to come forward in the trial court and say, Your Honor, I think the plaintiff should have sued me as well, or meant to. There's no case out there doing that.
You got any? What is the evidence of prejudice against the defendants? I mean, if the suit goes forward against the hospital, is there any records the hospital threw out, or people moved on if they didn't, in reliance on the fact that they didn't get served?
I think there's a presumed prejudice to the hospital due to the limitations expiration. There's nothing in the record about who threw out what, or what witnesses have lost what memories. We don't know. The point is, that's the whole point of limitations, is that there's an assumption that after a given period of time, in this case 2 years and 75 days after the plaintiff gave their notice in the 4590I letter, that those things are going to happen. And so I think we have that presumption in our benefit here. that the hospital has lost memories and has lost equipment. Actually, in the record, there is the evidence which that the laparoscopic tip itself is lost during this 2-year delay, which was permissible. But in any event, that certainly was lost.
Okay.
As far as why the court shouldn't adopt an equitable exception, I think first of all, what's going to happen is
an equitable exception to what?
I'm sorry. Whether this court should adopt an equitable exception to a service of process requirement. Right now, under the rules, it's clear that there is a service of process requirement, and I think the court's going to have to change the law if they're going to excuse the plaintiff's failure to serve at all, not even failure to serve diligently, but failure to sue to serve the hospital at all. And I think that first
because if the hospital had been served late, then there might be some question, a different question, about whether it related back or whether there was some other tolling of limitations.
Well, certainly there would have been a question at that point, limitations, which could have been presented to the trial court. And that's actually another prejudice that the hospital has suffered, is that at this point, if there is no service of process requirement, the hospital is not going to be able to assert diligence of service as a part of this limitations, because if there's no service requirement, then there's no diligence of service at all, and the plaintiff just has to appear, or the defendant has to appear. But to answer your question,
if there had been service, then I guess the way to analyze it would be to say, well, okay, we've been served, but now we claim limitations.
Right.
And then the plaintiff would say, well, but we contend that, number one, it relates back, and number two, it's been told.
Right. Well, I think there's only one argument, really, and that's that it relates back. I think Continental Southern Lines, because Highland allows a service that is outside the limitations period on a misidentified defendant to relate back if the requirements are satisfied, However, I think that still this court's jurisprudence on diligence of service should apply. And the trial court thought so, too. At the summary judgment hearing, this was discussed, and I think that the hospital expected to be served at that point. When the trial court asked the plaintiff's attorney, why didn't you serve the hospital, or why don't you serve them now, the attorney said, well, I think that then we would be faced with this limitations problem. And the trial court said, I agree. It's been 6 months or more since you joined them or amended the lawsuit to join them, and you haven't served them. I think there's no diligence here. And if you did join them at this point, limitations would apply. I think the trial court made that pretty clear. And I think that also answers the question of why the hospital was dismissed without prejudice. The trial court was giving them an opportunity to serve the hospital. So the issue could be keyed up, and there could be a determination made under Continental Southern Lines versus Highland, and the hospital could assert that defense, and they could decide whether diligence of service happened or not. And I think the trial court was clear that it had not. And in that case, it would have been a determination explicitly with prejudice as to the hospital. But that didn't happen because the plaintiff didn't serve the hospital.
I think I saw in the briefing some argument was made that they did not attempt service on the hospital because the joinder deadline had passed. Was there any attempt to extend the joinder deadline to allow them to obtain service on the hospital?
Well, there's no objection to their amendment of their petition to name the hospital and to join that deadline. The trial court didn't strike the pleading, so I don't think there was any issue as to the joinder deadline in this case. But one problem with allowing an equitable exception to the service process is that it's going to turn the rules on their heads. It really will. The plaintiff right now has the burden to go out and conduct an adequate pre-suit investigation, identify the proper defendant, and sue and serve that defendant. In this case, what you're going to do is you're going to turn the burden over onto unserved defendants, where if they find out about a lawsuit, they get actual notice of some lawsuit out there with someone with a similar name as to theirs, they, in prudence, should come forward and find out if they were the intended or proper defendant. And there may be cases like this happens. For example, in this case, there are a lot of Methodist hospitals. If Methodist Hospital in Dallas or Fort Worth or Austin or wherever finds out about a lawsuit in Houston in this Methodist hospital, it may be prudent of them to come forward and find out if they were served, if they were meant to be sued. because under the second exception, they could be considered to have been joined in the lawsuit and default judgment could be entered against them.
But you say on page 36 of one of your briefs that the federal rule does relax the relation back doctrine somewhat.
Well, for statute of limitations purposes, I think the Court of Appeals made the point in its brief that there was some relaxation of the service requirements of the federal rules. And I looked into that. The case cited was Johnson, and I can't remember the name. But when I looked into it, the only relaxation may have been, if there is any, is with regard to relation back for statute of limitations and tolling of statute of limitations for purposes.
Not for
service.
Excusing service
officers. No. In fact, I don't think, you know, reading all the cases that all the parties have cited in this case, there's not one other state, there's not one other federal jurisdiction that's ever adopted an equitable exception to the service process requirement where the plaintiff was aware of all the defendants, which the plaintiff was aware of all the defendants in this case. The plaintiff had time to properly serve the proper defendant, as the plaintiff did in this case, and there was no impediment to service whatsoever. There was none. The Memphis Hospital was 40 blocks down the road from the courthouse in Harris County, and for some reason, the plaintiff just decided not to serve the hospital. Now, this would be the first court in this country to create such an exception, and I think that this court shouldn't put itself in a position of leading the way on this issue, particularly when we had the Peralta versus Heights Medical Center case, which was cited in the briefing. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case. It's kind of old. It deals with Texas service rules. And under that case, the defendant actually received notice of the lawsuit. He was served with process, and he was served with the citation and the petition. But the citation was out of date, and it was void under Texas law. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, if you're served with void process, then you're not a party. And in this case, the trial court had entered a default judgment against the defendant. The Supreme Court said, no, that's a violation of due process. We can't allow that.
Yes, I mean, this may be a wrong analogy, but say you sued somebody and you never, you know, take any action. And in your position, obviously, the hospital didn't appear. So they never came into this suit, never came to this court. So I just filed suit against the hospital, but I don't serve them for years. Eventually, the judge is going to dismiss that for lack of prosecution. And under that scenario, presumably you get a notice and the judge calls you in and says, why haven't you served these people? I'm going to give you 20 days to serve them, or I'm going to dismiss your suit. So why wouldn't that, by analogy, apply here? Why didn't they give the plaintiff 20 days instead of this dismissal order? Why didn't they give them 20 days to serve? Are they going to be dismissed?
Well, the plaintiff had 6 months to serve or more. And, I'm sorry.
But when was, I mean, is it just inherent, or when was the plaintiff put on notice that they were going to suffer a dismissal if they didn't get this people served?
Well, the plaintiff was put on notice when the motion for summary judgment was filed at the latest. And there was a discussion at the pretrial hearing, which is not on the record, but it was discussed later at the summary judgment hearing, about whether this was an acceptable procedure. And apparently the plaintiff's lawyers agreed to the timetable. There was no debate about we need more time to serve. And really, in effect, because of the post-judgment new trial and grant of new trial and the second judgment, there was a lot of time in there where you know, the service could have been affected. And in fact, the hospital expected service. We thought the service was coming the day we filed the motion for summary judgment. I think another point that I wanted to make, which I may have made somewhat, to some extent, but I want to make it explicitly, is that the plaintiff's exception to the service process requirement is really inequitable if you look at it from the point of view of July 2001. Because the plaintiff already had an equitable exception that protected them in this circumstance. Assuming that the Highland exception could apply in total limitations, relate the petition back for purposes of limitations, the plaintiff was fully protected in this case. All she had to do was name in her petition the proper defendant who was identified to them by the system in their amended answer in July 2001, and they did that in August 2001, and then bring that defendant into the lawsuit and if by service, which is the accepted way and the only way to bring a person into court to deprive them of due process, deprive them of property under due process rules. And the plaintiff just didn't do that. So really, if this court is creating a second equitable exception on top of it, I'm sorry, can I
finish your sentence?
If the court creates a second equitable exception on top of that equity they already have, then all they're really doing is bailing them out in a case where they don't have clean hands. And the hospital at this point has disclosed everything it can possibly disclose. Or, I'm sorry, the system has disclosed everything it can possibly disclose.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Counsel, we have not talked about the motion for new trial, and I have a question about it. Clearly, the motion for new trial was granted. The order says that. Is that correct?
Some of the relief from the motion is that it was granted.
Well, it just says motion for new trial was granted. Orally, at which the court orally granted the plaintiff's motion for new trial. And then it goes on to say that the judge promised to and did reread the documents and then decided that the summary judgment was still proper. Why isn't that granting all the relief that you asked for in the motion for new trial and for reconsideration?
Because the motion for new trial and for reconsideration asks that the motion for summary judgment be denied on the merits. If you look at that combined motion, there are two sections of it. The first section of it assails, as the lingo has it, the ruling of the court on the summary judgment. The second section of it talks about a timeliness issue that is long ago dropped out of the case, timeliness of the summary judgment for this court. If that motion had been refiled without the second section talking about timeliness, after what became the final judgment in this case, it would have been a perfectly acceptable motion for new trial.
And then one other question on that score. If there had been, let's just make the worst example we can think of, if there had been a jury trial and a verdict against you, there was judgment on the verdict, you moved for new trial, the judge granted the new trial, tried the case over. Another verdict, also against you, judgment on that verdict. Does that motion, which still asks for a judgment in your favor, not one against you, operate to extend the appellate deadline?
No, because I don't think that is, if I understand the example correctly, that does not assail the second jury verdict that ultimately gets resolved into the second judgment.
It's hard for me to see why the one assails the summary judgment, but the other one does not.
Because they've been different jury trials.
But there were different summary judgment hearings.
However, it's the same summary judgment. It's the same.
Oh, but there was even different evidence, right?
No, that's correct. That's correct. But the arguments are all the same. The rulings of the court are all the same. They are the same on the same assertions. I think inherently, if you're talking about trying a case to a jury two times, well, we know that it doesn't happen the same way two times in a row.
But just so I'll be clear, I haven't looked at the record. The evidence at the second hearing was different. I mean, that was the point of the motion. Consider this other evidence.
Yeah, and what it primarily is, if you look at that evidence, there is some evidence that the trial attorneys gathered from the world at large, but it is mostly discovery pleadings and pleadings that were filed by the parties in the lawsuit. The description of it as being 400 pages of evidence is a little misleading. It is certainly 400 pages, but it's mostly pages of stuff that either was or could have been in the court file, discovery files and pleadings. Judge Jefferson's question. The system says we said there was no possible defendants because by that time the statute had run. That cannot be the right response. There either are defendants or there are not possible defendants. They may have defenses, i.e., they've got a statute of limitations defense, but that does not make them a non-defendant. There is still an obligation to disclose them under the disclosure rule. For instance, that defendant might not assert the statute of limitations defense.
Let me ask you, it strikes me there are a number of escape valves along the way that could have prevented this from happening. We've named a few. One is discovery sanctions against the system. Another one is going ahead and affecting service and then arguing equitable tolling for relation back purposes on limitations. There are maybe a few others I can't recall, but there are a number of escape valves that the plaintiff could have availed, she could have availed herself of to get out of the conundrum that we're in right now. And so why should we apply an equitable exception to something as fundamentally important as service of process when there are other escape valves to prevent something like this from happening?
I think that it is true that the plaintiff could have asked for discovery sanctions, and I think it is true that we do not know what the trial court would have done.
But that's always going to be the case.
With regard to discovery sanctions.
But you'd agree there are other escape valves available.
We know what the trial court would have done had the plaintiff attempted to issue service, because it's real clear in those hearings, Judge Lindsay is telling the plaintiff that I think that you have not shown due diligence thus far in trying to bring these. But Judge Lindsay takes plaintiff's attorneys to task for not doing precisely what you're suggesting they ought to have done.
But if there's no due diligence on that piece, you know, we shouldn't be talking about equity first instance.
The problem is that this court's decisions say that when we're talking about Hilland, I think I've been saying Hillard, but Hilland is the case, that doctrine, the equitable exception, the court has said in the Inserts versus Parker case, due diligence is not the question. The question is whether the proper defendant had notice and was prejudiced.
Well, but that was due diligence in terms of ferreting out who the proper party was. Here we're talking about an entirely different due diligence when you do know who the proper party is and you fail to serve them.
We're assuming, the court is assuming, something that I think the record reflects is not true, and that is that the plaintiff knew that they had the wrong party until Judge Lindsay told them and bringing some of the judgment motion. I think that there is clear that the plaintiff thought she had the hospital in the lawsuit by virtue of suing the system.
But you amended, at some point you amended to name the hospital.
The system DBA as the hospital, I believe, is the way that the amendment went. And the amendment's not great either. I'm not arguing that it is. But it is indicative of the fact that the plaintiff thought that she had done the process correctly all along. The people that knew that it was not correctly is the system.
Once they filed their sworn pleas, if you sued the wrong person, you sued us in the wrong capacity, somebody else is liable. At that point, why didn't you go out and serve the hospital?
The better practice would certainly have been to have done that. And I don't know the answer why logistically they did not do that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. These cases are submitted on the briefs. Oral argument. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.